I'm Michael, I'm an addict.
I'm Michael.
I just want to see you in the back. Actually, what I want to do is just look at your eyes, actually, what I'd like to do. You can hear me for the moment. I'd just like to look around the room and look into your eyes. I would. I just want to look into your eyes. Because this thing, to me, is about love and about me standing here being willing to be who I am. Just look into your eyes. I don't know all of you. I know some of you. Because there's a healing energy in this room and all NA rooms. That's really powerful. I feel that. I mean, I just feel it running through me. You know, there's a healing energy in this room. Well, I don't want to sound like Robert Duvall and the Apostle, but there's a healing you know, that bit where he does that. No, I'm not going to do that bit. There's a healing energy in this room.
God. Jesus!
Amen.
There's a healing energy in this room. And first I'd like to thank Gary for hosting this and Karen for doing a share that really distilled it together. And I've got to find 40 minutes to speak to you without telling a lie, which is impossible for me to do. So, there are people here I haven't seen for a long time. Tollis, I know Tollis 30 years. Jeff, I know for 32 years. I'm 32 years clean and sober.
Wow.
And no. You're going to hear a cautionary tale as how not to do it, probably. I'm as surprised as anyone. But what I did, why I stood up, is because each one of you is my companion in the shipwreck that they call life. Each one of you. And the difference between us and, I believe, the people outside is we know life is a shipwreck. They don't. We know we ended up on the island of washed up, misplaced toys and didn't know why we were there. And somehow or other, you know, there's that biblical expression, the stone the builder had discarded became our cornerstone. I'm going to do that Robert Duvall thing. It sounds like we're going to channel him tonight. But it's true, isn't it? Isn't that what they're talking about, the addict? We were discarded and are discarded. And yet, you know, we live amazing lives, extraordinary lives. And as Karen said, you know, at the end of the day, you get this GPS, you know, that when I'm on, you know, when I haven't been hitting the porn on the internet and separating myself from myself, locking myself out of my own house, I can stand up and look at each one of you in the eye. I could never do that before. Never do that before. That's what that's given me. It's also good to look around the room, see if there's anybody you slept with, but it doesn't look like maybe your mothers or your fathers, you know. More about that later. You think I'm kidding? You know that wonderful line in that Leonard Cohen song, you know, it says that there were so many people you had to meet without your clothes. And, you know, that was my story too. Just take drugs to get out of your clothes and wake up with strangers, hopefully without strange animals, just strangers. I was introduced to drugs in 1970 in New York City, and I had just spent 3 years in the Royal Marines in England. And yeah, of course they're in England, aren't they? They're the Royal Marines, the American Marines. It's a redundant expression. And I'd signed up for 9 years. I made the mistake of reading a book called Beau Geste about when I was a kid, you know, about joining the French Foreign Legion. Well, they were a long way away, and I didn't speak French, so I joined the Marines in some attempt to prove my masculinity. And after, I was hoping I'd got a scholarship to a public school, so I could speak properly if I wanted to. And although I came from, you know, immigrant family, And you know, I wasn't going to stay. I wasn't going to commission and being in the lower deck of the Marines in the late 60s, where everybody else was like getting stoned and going to Bob Dylan, and you know, we just drank. It was like being in prison. And so I decided with my friends on the mess deck that I would get out. They said, "You can't get out. You can stay here for 6 years, at least 6 years, and even buy your way out." I said, "You watch me," and I said, "I'm gay." And that was before it was fashionable, you know, or legal. And of course, part of that was true because, well, certainly I was having homosexual sex because I would be coming up to London and going to a bar called the Apollo, which is on Wardour Street. Now, if you know what the Apollo was, you must be old, because the Apollo became a big venue for music, evidently. It was on Wardour Street, became a big, hip, edgy venue for music. But when I went there, you went there to trick. In other words, you slept with men for money. And that's what I did, to supplement my income, which was like, and my drug taking then was restricted totally to drink. I didn't take drugs. I mean, in those days, I mean, I had a girlfriend who was a heroin addict. I knew I was an addict. I knew if I started to take something like heroin, I'd never stop. You know, I knew that part about myself. I had to control what I did. And in those days, at least, you know, the kids from St. Albans, where I came from, much like a hayseed, you know, a joint was this thing with toilet, like a toilet roll, and a very complicated procedure. It was just easier just to get, you know, get smashed on booze, which is what I did. And so after I lied to get out of the Marines, I went and found an American who'd been a divinity teacher with his lover at the Apollo, and I got a one-way ticket to New York. I had $40 in my pocket in 1970. This is the start of my drug taking. So me, the defrocked divinity teacher and three children and his boyfriend and me go to New York with my $40. And it was on Loflida in those days. Loflida was the Icelandic airline where, you know, basically an engine would generally break down in Prestwick. You'd be there for a couple of days as they fix the engine. You go to Reykjavik, you'd be very cold, and they'd start giving you brandy on the final leg. It was very sexy and very glamorous. And I started to, you know, I met somebody in New York here, and it's later in the story about why I've been in New York for 18 months, but I remember when the meeting downtown, that I go to in New York is Bleecker Street. And, you know, some of you have been to Bleecker Street. It's a great meeting. It's like a great Tuesday meeting. It's kind of like, it's like this, really. Sort of like this. Anyway. It's a great meeting. It's now in Chinatown, but it was down in Soho and for many years. Oldest meeting in New York. And if I go around, there's a lovely Italian restaurant to eat around the corner down on 6th and Houston there. And you have to walk past Minetta Lane. And I'm 64. As I walk past Minetta Lane, I remember that place I used to trick out as a male prostitute. You know, that's one of the reasons I come to NA, because I can actually look at you and say that. And I know that somebody else has done it. Somebody else has done it. You may not put it on your fourth step, but I know you've done it. Go on, tell your sponsor. You'll probably say I did it too. So that's the Sun headline part of the story out, you know. He was a male prostitute. Yes, I was. And I was quite good at it too. There's an old expression, that's a true expression, which is that old hustlers never die, they just buy it back. And when they told me that, you know, you get these stories like, you know, it's true. It's true. Because 10 years clean, I found myself in the sex addiction rehab in Torrance, California. Now, when you go to Los Angeles, you don't generally go down to Torrance. It's on the way to Newport Beach. It's not the place you stay in. I was in this juvenile hall, which had been beaten up by the juveniles, and I was paying $32,000. Actually, not, because I got a discount, Jeff, even though I'm not Jewish, and I paid $25 in cash. So 10 years sober, or clean, I was clean because I'd been going to NA since I came to England, I find myself living the dream and living the aphorism about old hustlers never diet back in this sex addiction rehab, which is being run by Patrick Carnes, who's a big guy in that sex recovery. Because One of the things I didn't realise that my was, and this is the genius of this programme, and it's why I come to this programme, is this programme deals with addiction, and addiction manifests itself in a number of different ways. You see, I'm not really a sex addict. I use sex as a drug. I'm an addict. And I will use anything, food, gambling. I like to say I'm not a gambler. I'm a total gambler. I'm a degenerate gambler. But I just don't go to bookmakers. I just gamble with a lot of other stuff. I put my head in nooses all the time. Now, if I were to sit here and start cutting my arm, you'd go, that guy's self-harming. And I'd say, I'm self-harming. But I self-harm in very different ways, ways that I disguise myself with. And that's part of this illness that I have. And I have to remind myself that when I think, my thinking is different than other people. I'm wired in a different way. In the other program, they say we're bodily and mentally different, and I buy that. By the way, I didn't come in a suit because Gary's grand sponsor makes people go in suits when he goes to meetings. I came because it's my uniform. So I mean, some of those meetings you've got to go in a suit and everything else. But awesome. I know his sponsor. He met him in Vegas. I'm going all over the place here, but I've got time, haven't I? So, sit back and relax. Anyway, the sex addiction, you want to hear about the sex addiction, just in case. First, I got evaluated by this nurse who was 600 pounds, and I told him that. No, good idea. Well, actually, it's not true. I was making a lot of money in those days. I was like, you know, my idea was with addiction, make the money, then you can draw the curtains and open the curtains and draw the curtains. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? On you. I don't have to see you when I don't want to see you. I can shut you. Money lets me do it. It's a lie. It's not true. Because it's all in here. It's all in here. And I bunged my sponsor, who lives in Santa Monica, $5,000 in cash. He's an artist struggling. If you put your sponsor on the payroll if you can afford to. Because it kind of ameliorates that, you know, didactic thing, like do the fucking steps or you'll use again, you prick. Here's another $5,000. I'll buy one of your paintings. Well, that keeps them quiet for a while. About 17 days into this thing, 28 days in the sex rehab. Not alcohol. I mean, there's a couple of alkies. There was a very dark alky in there, a children thing. I'm not going to go into that because it's just painful. But and he had to stay on his own. But there were dentists who had been fiddling about with the patients under the gas, and they were losing their tickets. They were court mandated. I was there to save my marriage. I'd had two beautiful little children, right, and a wife who had just started going to Al-Anon, a couple of years in Al-Anon, right, and she thought it was over, and so I went there to save this marriage because I was just, you know, I was making a lot of money and I was just, it was commercial sex other than when it wasn't commercial sex, but it wasn't an affair or anything like that. It was just sex as a drug. I was using sex exactly the way I use drink and drugs. And so about 17 days in, it came that 11 days' time, my wife would be coming over for family week. Now you can imagine, family week. I'm sure some of you have been through family week, but family week at the Sex Addiction Treatment Centre in Torrance, California, that's what you'd call one of the highlights of recovery. And I started to get afraid. And also I was starting to have the dreams. It was coming up in the night. I couldn't sleep at night. And what Karen was talking about, that fear, not feeling the fear, that fear started to come up. That fear I buried with money, with meetings, with sponsoring people. That fear of myself started to come up. It was about 10 years. It was 93. So I got clean in 82, late 82, so it's about 10 years. It started to come up. Because I hadn't done the work. I'd pay. I also thought, well, can't you pay somebody to do these steps for you? I mean, if you make enough money, can't you? Surely a therapist could do it. Maybe God could do some of these steps for you too, if he was generous about it. But this self-examination stuff, and actually some of that deep shame I felt about Minetta Lane and all that other stuff that I'm able to say now, because let's face it, I'm 64. I ain't going to get laid unless I've really got a lot of money and I'm broke, you know. I'm married, by the way, I forgot, you know. And that ship sailed a long time ago. You can imagine my wife, 29 years of putting up with me. Jeez, she's going to be a saint. And she's also a trustee of Al-Anon, believe it or not. Right? So there's always a side benefit. If you think it's that bad, you could be helping somebody. You never know. You never know. It's two small children. And I checked out of that place, you know. I checked out of that place. I said, I'm all right. And I got the other $5,000, because I had $10,000, out of the thing. And I went to the Lowe's in Santa Monica on the beach, and I went to an AA meeting with my sponsor. And had some dinner, whatever it was. Looked a bit of soft porn on the, you know, in America on the channel. And got on my knees to pray. And the next thing I had was an overwhelming desire to throw myself through the window. It's not a desire, it was an impulse. And all of that suicidal stuff started to come up in me that had been shut down. Now, my sponsor for 10 years had been saying, Michael, for you, no drinking, no drugging, no suicide. And I'd say, Bobby, you're the suicidal one. You're the guy who stuck so much steel in his arm that, you know, looked like hamburger meat. That wasn't me, that was you. You're the one who gets on his knees any morning saying, God, give me a reason not to kill myself today. I'm not like you. Now my sponsor is, you know, is a guy, you know, who's known by people, you know, he lives in Hollywood, he's a poet and a painter and a screen, he's hip, you know, he's 11 years older than me. And I just thought it was just the world he lived in, you know, and the Maxis Kansas City and the amount he'd done that was suicidal. He recognized in me for 10 years something I was completely oblivious, something I was completely unaware of, was the truth of that thing that Carl Menninger wrote about in a book called Man Against Himself. Man Against Himself was written in 1938, the year before the big book was written. And Menninger, who was running a clinic with his dad, and he was a psychiatrist, this book, Man, what a wonderful title, Man Against Himself, doesn't that sort of say something about addiction? He said, he categorized suicide, he put addicts and alcoholics in the third category of chronic suicide, addicts and alcoholics. And that was the truth for me. That deep inside, that, you know, this disease doesn't want me loaded. It doesn't want me drunk. It wants me dead. You know, dead like Johnny Too Bad. Dead like Steve, you know, like Philip Seymour Hoffman. Dead like what happened. You know, you go over or you jump off a building or whatever it is. And that's the issue. So were it just about stopping, right? And by the way, I didn't give the caveat. This is my story. This may not be your story. It's not in the book. It's my story. I'm here to bear witness to this story, because if there is somebody in this room feeling like killing yourself, I know how you're feeling, right? You're afraid to tell somebody about it. I was afraid. I was afraid for about 3 or 4 years. And I had to get deep. I had to go and recommit myself. And sometimes when you've got time, it's difficult to do that, because you've got a carapace, you've got this outside, you know, you've got this time, you've got a badge, you've got 32 years, you've got whatever it is, and you haven't got the days, you haven't got the time, and you haven't been doing the work. Anyway, I believe with every fiber of my being that there's a God that loves me absolutely today, and I believe with every fiber of my being that there's a God that loves you absolutely today. And if that's all you get out of this, it's everything. Because life is a shipwreck. I was a hustler and a grifter, and money was my God, you know, and it became my God in the program. And I wouldn't have been a good drug dealer, you know. I mean, I don't know why. I just didn't. That wasn't my risk. I take plenty of risk, but that's what I was, you know. And I ended up owning a member of the stock exchange, and that demutualized. I made $5 million, you know, in the bank. I had the racing sloop, it run around the island. I had the Bentleys, the whole lot, right? It's gone now, by the way. If you were building a resentment, it's gone. Broke, 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 broke. I could show you pictures. And some of them would be mine. I'm jumping all over the place. On May the 10th, 2012, I was flying into Kennedy Airport, and I went into that room. They asked me to go into that room where they, you know, normally where the Iraqis go. If there's anybody Iraq, it's not because you're Iraq, I'm saying that. You know, you normally have a few goats and sheep and people who look like they're never going into the States. You know, I go into that room. And normally it's because of a couple of arrests. You know, it's normally because I had an arrest in 72 and an arrest in something else. And I look for a kind of big Irish guy, you know, who to go to, like, Captain, I'm an American, I'm a lawyer. I wasn't then, but I am a lawyer. I'm an American lawyer, I'm an English barrister, that's why I'm dressed like this. But that's impressed you, doesn't it? Yeah. Just shows. No, it doesn't impress him. Yeah, because it's a quick way. That's why I'm broke. It's because I'm a fucking barrister. I don't make any money. You think it's great. It's a lot sexier to tell someone you're a barrister than actually to be one. Yeah. No, but paperwork, which I hate. It's not paperwork, it's talking, which I like, as you can tell. In fact, somebody said it's a travesty for me to get paid to argue. But they arrested me. And it was for something I hadn't done. And that really pisses you off, you know. Because there's all that guilt about the stuff you never got arrested for. That's sort of weighing like this, and there's this thing. And you're kind of like imbalanced. And you're also in handcuffs. Imbalanced in handcuffs. And there was these two IRS guys, because it's the tax people who got me, you know, because they said I helped people hide their money in Switzerland, and I must have been pretty ineffective at it, because I'd only just bumped myself up to premium economy. I wasn't coming in first class or anything special. I paid the 120. I got like a lottery ticket. Thank God I did. It was the last decent meal I had in a while. You know, and they put them on very tight. Fucking back. And I'm used to seeing people in the cells as their advocate, not like this. And they took me down to this place, they arraigned me, and then it's in the press, you know, because English barrister arrested at Kennedy, and my daughter was doing a finals at Leeds, you know, at that time. And it was on the telly, my 15 minutes of fame arrest out there, and then they put me in the punishment block of the MCC downtown, where you're locked up all the time, and it's not fun. And the second day, of course, I'm thinking, you know, at that moment when you're thinking, I'm 29 years clean and fucking sober, and I'm in the MCC in the punishment block, and you're saying to this guard, is there a meeting here? Now, seriously, you say this, and they go, you need a drug counsellor? You need a drug counsellor? No. I said, a meeting. You got a drug problem? I said, no, I need a meeting, don't you understand? I need to be in a room like this with people like you, because that healing energy is what I know. You need a drug counsellor. I'm going to get a drug counsellor. They want to give you drugs. And I'm with this racist maniac. You do not want to be a racist in the, you know, you do not want to be a racist in the punishment block there, because everybody's Spanish and black. You really don't want to be a cracker racist who's insane. Well, that was my roommate. Next day, they get rid of him. Thank God for that. He's been kicking around the system, and I get this lovely black guy in there. He looked like Eddie Murphy's younger brother, you know. He was the enforcer for a crack area. He showed me where he'd been shot through there and there. And he was on it. And he thinks I'm a snitch, and, you know, I don't really understand this. You know, I've never really done any serious time. But he does remember he was in treetops and that PCP he was smoking. So we end up right at the steps out, having a first step NA meeting, second day. Now here comes the miracle. They arraign me. They want $2 million in bail. $2 million. Now I pissed away all that other money because I gambled that $5 million on a roll to make 50, and it just, you know, like I'm not a gambler. You'd probably be happy with 5 million, wouldn't you? You'd think, how the fuck could an idiot piss that away? Because he rolled it to make 50. But I don't go to Vegas. It would have been cheaper to go to Vegas. I rolled it in a lawsuit, in an intellectual property lawsuit. I'm so clever, I pissed the fucking money away. Anyway, I'm working, but I don't have $2 million. In cash, they wanted it. And a guy in the program who knows his grand sponsor, who's actually sponsored by your grand sponsor, wrote a check out for $1.3 million cash. Got me out. It's impressive, isn't it? I mean, you know, money. I mean, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And I got out. Not very far. They put a tag on me, one of those like fucking bombs things, and they wouldn't let me go to meetings. And that's why I ended up at Bleecker Street, because I used to go to, I had an AA men's home group there that I'd gotten sober in. How much time have I got?
10 minutes.
10? Fucking hell. I haven't even started on my using yet. And what I found was I was being judged, you know, because people in there would be saying, yeah, well, I know the guys in their 20 years, you know, that's when they fucking go off the reservation and, you know, they'd read about it and I was guilty and, you know. And I went back to NA where nobody gave a shit about what I'd done. You're on bail, so fucking what? So is everybody else here, you know. I try to be respectable, but it just doesn't. Did I swear? I did swear, didn't I?
You did.
I shouldn't have sworn.
Yeah, five off it.
Five. I'll send you a check. And it was a long road back, and it was, you know, it was part of my journey to do that. It was part of my journey, and I'm still facing life imprisonment, essentially, with all, you know, the way they lay it out, you know. I got 14 years for this I'm supposed to be doing, I'm still doing it. And it just so happens, all right, that I became a lawyer at 50 years old, and I'm able to, and I'm an American lawyer, and I'm an English barrister, so I can defend myself. And we've got a judge who's called the prosecutor, a liar. And I'm living in a situation, and I was saying this to Jeff, who's my old friend over there, that my purpose in life is really to show that this program works under all conditions, right? No matter what's going on, there's plenty of people. I've got a sponsor who's been my sponsor 28 years. He's got Lois dementia and Parkinson's. Right? Bob was one of the founders of Goldman Sachs here. He was a big wheel. When I was a trader, in the market for about 25 years. And before I made the really clever decision to become a lawyer, which is one of the reasons I'm arrested, is because I was a lawyer, you know, in this situation. And Bob's got this, and he's in Maryland. While I was in New York, I was able to drive down on the weekends and see him, you know, because when you're losing your mind and you're clean, it's difficult, you know. And then I see the courage that people have who go through illnesses. My friends who've gone through Hep C, 2-3 sets of interferon, and there's a guy out in LA now we're praying for who it just hasn't taken, you know, and he's gonna die, you know. And we wonder, you know, that we did that, all those things, those risks we took, that we didn't keep putting our heads in nooses. You know, that in alcoholism, in the other fellowship, they talk about, I sabotage myself. I still do. I still am reckless with myself. I still don't care about myself. And what you have all given me is that kind of trite aphorism, which is, we'll love you until you learn to love yourself. You know, one of the benefits I have of my home group, which is the boys' own, which is why I haven't seen many of you beautiful girls that often, because I live near Winchester, and I come up, and it's Tuesday night, I go out with the lads, and it's very special to me that, I've lost my train of thought, it doesn't matter. It's very special to me, got another tack, that I can be accepted by myself. You know, I think that's really the point. I used cocaine for, I think, 8 years. And people said to me, and I don't have a great tolerance for narcotics. I only took heroin when they told me it was something else. It was in the East Village in the early 70s when it wasn't a hip place like it is now. And heroin in the East Village then was like the local crop. It was like spaghetti in Italy, you know. It was like what you like. They grew it probably. I don't know what the fuck they did. It was there. Somebody gave it to me, and I knew it, and I knew what it was, and it was so good. That one time I did it, I never did it again, because I just know I have to control my using. Cocaine, I thought, oh, fuck, you know, what could... Cocaine is snorting. I mean, I'm shooting it, I'm not doing it. How can I fucking do anything to me? And it was hip. The guy who turned me on to cocaine, I can remember it like yesterday. We were in the Jockey Club in Florida. And it was, none of, I don't think anybody's old enough here to remember Jockey Club. That was the hip place. It was one of those kind of kitsch American scenes where the swimming pool went into the living room. You know, you could see the people swimming. It was the penthouse. There was a guy who was always on, like, underage girls charges, you know. And the guy I was living with at the time was representing him, I think, or something. I don't know. It was one of those things. And you know, it was a decadent, degenerate scene that I was attracted to. I was attracted to the dark. I was attracted to the darkness, you know. And I was attracted to it, and I failed at it because I was attracted and repelled. Attracted and repelled. I'm a failed drug addict. That's what Karen said. I'm a failed rebel, I'm a failed grifter, I'm a failed hustler, because there was always something in me that said, no, this is wrong. Always something in me said there was a creator. And what came out of that experience, with that suicidal experience, was a renewal of faith, allowed me to see that I didn't create myself. And I was able to see that, was given the gift of seeing that before I killed myself. Johnny Too Bad didn't get that gift. Philip Seymour Hoffman didn't get that gift. Things stood in the way. I loved Johnny Too Bad. We all loved Johnny Too Bad. That funeral was one of the most amazing things. I can remember our family, you know, and the great blessing I... Well, we got two or one. Three. How I came to NA from the other fellowship, because when I was getting in and out in New York, there was very little NA, and it was a very different scene. Is because when I came back to England in 83, I've been in and out eight times, 8 years. I was given Dudley's number. One telephone number, Dudley. Dudley, who brought the program here. And Dudley brought the program here. And Dudley said, I'm busy, I just got a job. But anyway, he took me to Early Risers, which was a meeting we used to go to. It started at noon, of course, Early Risers on Sunday. And something happened. Something happened to me because I was hiding out in there, because I'm an addict through, you know, if you cut me like Brighton Rock, you'd see addict. Except I don't believe, you know, I want to disguise it, but I'm an addict. And then the journey came, and I didn't want to read the NA literature. I didn't want to look at these other things. I felt that just not drinking and taking drugs gave me license to do these other things, and I certainly caned them as much as I possibly can. But I'm here to tell you that the road gets narrower and narrower, but also the blessings get greater and greater, you know. And so I'm being sustained right now through this situation where I'll have a trial later this year, probably. I've got depositions to go through. A whole bunch of fear. I've got to work like a demon to keep things together. You know, my wife is still with me. Amazing people have helped me. Amazing people have come. And I'm somebody who doesn't like to be helped. I don't like to say those words, please help me. But those were the words 32 years ago on July the 6th, 1982, that came out of my mouth. And as I remember those words, please help me. And because I've mouthed those or prayed those words, it helped us come. I'm here to say that, you know, my experience, what I'm going through now, I hope it encourages anybody to say, well, I can't go through this, I'm not going to be able to go through this. And by the way, it's my liberty, it's not my health that's at stake. You know, and I think, well, my health to be at stake, it would be a very different matter. But I'm blessed, you know, to be part of this family. Part of, you know, you're part of me and I'm part of you, you know, independent of everything else. We're conjoined together in a way that's so special and so different. I'm in a room of people. I don't know if there's 100 people in here, not tonight, I'm not sure. But there's 100 people who are no less than New Testament miracles. No less than blind seeing, lame walking, no less. We don't celebrate it that way. You know, they wrote a book and it's the biggest book in the world about that. We live that. We live the New Testament, the Bible. Thank you.